Questions about anything? So the plan is to go on today to STARS. I don't know how far we'll get into it. So that's chapter 17. The big project for this next exam is to identify STARS. So if you look online, there's a list of STARS that you need to know for quizzes and the exam. That's star names and extra information. And it'll be a little bit different. I think it's probably a harder process. So for this, I'll probably be giving you lines and dots in order to identify the STARS. But there's probably more information to know. And I mean, we're certainly not going to start that this week, testing you on it, but wouldn't hurt to start to get to know that stuff. Questions? So I've been talking about the sun. And I know, starting in the 50s when computers were available, people started to calculate how the inside of the sun worked. And it's not really a very tricky problem. What goes into it is pretty clear. Hydrostatic equilibrium, that's just the fact that the pressure is the weight of the overlying layers of the sun. Newtonian gravity, that the force of gravity falls off like 1 over r squared. The fact that the sun is gaseous all the way down, so even if we're talking about stuff that has a density that's 10 times that of lead, it still follows to high accuracy the ideal gas law. So that higher pressures mean higher densities and lower temperatures mean higher densities. And those density, pressure, temperature are related in that fashion. Thermonuclear energy release. If we know the composition and we know how hard the collisions are, we can simulate those in our laboratories. And it's a big computational problem, but you can calculate how much thermonuclear energy would be released for any given pressure and temperature. Then you have to move that energy through the sun, and through 70% of the distance, the energy is being transferred by radiation, and we know how light works. That's a pretty straightforward problem. Convection is a little bit trickier problem, because there we're talking about fluids in motion, and it's chaotic fluids in motion. It's not really something you could exactly calculate. So to the extent that there are difficulties in this process, the problems are in modeling convection. And in fact, there's kind of a free parameter that people adjust in their models of convection in order to make the model that's inside the computer match the sun that we actually observe. So convection is in fact tricky. The convection as it occurs in the sun, it turns out we can't duplicate in labs. It's particularly vigorous convection. So it's we can simulate it with computers, but you can't actually make convection in a laboratory that would match the convection that's going on in the sun. So it's convection is the tricky part and the part that people still kind of argue about today for solar interiors. But remember, that's just kind of the outer 30% of the sun. So most of what's going on is really quite straightforward stuff and hasn't really changed much since the 50s. What has changed is we now really have the ability to see inside the sun using sound. So just as we can see inside the Earth using the sound produced by earthquakes, we can see inside the sun because it is vibrating and that sound is traveling through the interior of the sun. And we can detect these vibrations by looking at the surface moving up and down and the Doppler effect that causes. The speeds are pretty slow, but Doppler effect and on a bright source like the sun works pretty well. So we actually have quite accurate measurements of the temperature and density, kind of 0.5% accuracy throughout the sun. Kind of the exception is right at the core, since it's unlikely for sound to have come right from the core. You know, usually it'll make some sort of glancing transit through the sun. The details about the core are kind of left out with the helioseismometry. Okay, so I mean, we think we understand what's going on with the sun, but you see things labeled problems here. So these are things that didn't compute, that didn't work out. And probably the most famous of these and the most significant of these is the solar neutrino problem. And we've seen that thermonuclear energy release in the proton-proton chain requires the release of neutrinos. So if you know how much energy is being released, you can calculate how many neutrinos are supposed to be released. And neutrinos are extremely unreactive, so they go right through the sun, and unfortunately they therefore also go right through our detectors pretty much without interacting. But there's an extraordinarily huge flux of those neutrinos, 100 billion per centimeter squared per second here at the Earth. So if you make sensitive enough detectors that are big enough, you actually can detect neutrinos. And this was a process that started by Ray Davies in Leeds, South Dakota, circa 1964. And the result was that we got just about a third that we expected. It's a complicated enough experiment, and people thought they understood the sun well enough that they figured that the experiment had been done wrong. So people did this repeatedly, and they continually came up with a shortage of neutrinos. And the problem seems to be solved, although all the details aren't worked out, and that is that we now know that neutrinos do oscillate. That is to say, an electron neutrino that's produced at the center of the sun will oscillate into a mix of muon neutrino and tau neutrino, and these detectors only detect the electron neutrinos. So it's kind of no surprise that we're missing about a third of them. Coronal heating problem. So you know you can't heat something hotter than the thing that's doing the heating. If you put your cake in an oven that's at 450 degrees, you expect it to be 450 degrees, not 4,000 degrees. But that's not the case with the corona. So the corona is 1,000 times hotter, maybe 200 times hotter than the surface of the sun. And you would guess that it's the sun that's heating it. So it must be that the source that is heating the corona can't be the surface of the sun, so-called surface of the sun. Remember, it's gas all the way down. And the energy that's heating the corona must have its source in something that is 2 million degrees hot, and that's about the temperature of the base of the convection layer. And so the best guess is that some sort of sound, I put sound in quotes because this is magnetized plasma, and turns out there are lots of ways waves can propagate through magnetized plasma, not just the same ways that can travel through air. So the complicated name for that is magnetohydrodynamics. So some combination of magnetic field and sound is probably propagating one way or the other from the base of this convection layer to the corona, and the waves are breaking in the corona and depositing their energy there, heating it. So it must be that we know that the sun is largely transparent to its sound. That's why we can detect it. So it's kind of no surprise that something like this is possible. So we saw last time that the surface features of the sun are strongly influenced by the magnetic field of the sun. And the magnetic field of the planets and the sun are not bar magnets the way we're used to. They're actually electromagnets. So there are electric currents that are flowing inside the Earth, inside the sun, that are making the magnetic field of the sun and the Earth and the other planets. And the requirements for that are some conducting, convecting fluid. And we know we've got convection because we see the convective layers. We see the top of those layers and the granules. And we know we've got a conducting fluid because it's a plasma. So kind of no surprise that the sun would have a magnetic field. In the case of the Earth, the conducting, convecting fluid is the iron in the liquid iron core of the Earth. And we know that the Earth's field reverses occasionally, kind of randomly on kind of a million-year timescale. What's different about the sun is that it reverses at a relatively faster pace. So if today the top half of the sun is a north pole, 11 years from now the top half of the sun might be a south pole, and 11 years after that would be back to being a north pole. So 22-year cycle to complete a magnetic field reversal, getting back to the same situation. So the sunspot cycle is situations where we have lots of spots or few spots, and you remember the location of those spots follows that sort of butterfly pattern. There's some evidence that this cycle isn't continuously operating. It has been continuously operating kind of since science was into monitoring the sun 24 hours a day, as it were. But there's some evidence that this cycle stops. There's some evidence that the sunspot cycle affects the weather. All of those things are kind of hard to understand because the sun really is a very constant source of light and heat. So it only varies by parts per thousand, and kind of the surprising fact is that it's actually brighter when it is spotted than when it's not spotted. So currently we're just starting to go to a maximum for our sunspots. So you're starting to hear about northern lights, whereas you really haven't heard about northern lights in the last 3, 4, 5 years because we've been at a low for sunspotting. Questions on all of that? So we then started to kind of review the basic, how we get the basic numbers for the sun. And the reason for doing this is we're going to want to find similar numbers to the extent that we can for the stars. So it takes light about 8 minutes to go from the sun to the Earth, and we can actually bounce radar signals off the sun and the other planets. So we can get distances inside the solar system to within centimeter accuracy. So we have extremely accurate measurements of the 150 million kilometers that separates the Earth from the sun. We see the sun as a disk, right? So we can, you know, use our protractors to measure the angle from the top of the sun to the bottom of the sun. We can get the angular diameter of the sun, and it's roughly about half a degree. So this thing here, this half a degree size of the sun, that's been known since the Greeks. It doesn't take anything too complicated to measure it. The distances are more complicated, and really, before radar, people were somewhat uncertain about it. But I don't know, for at least a couple of hundred years, people have had pretty accurate distances to the sun. If you know the triangle that is the angle to the top and bottom of the sun and the distance to the sun, then you can just use trigonometry to get the physical diameter of the sun. To get the mass of the sun, we use Kepler's third law. So if we have objects that are orbiting around each other, we showed that the mass of the central object could be determined by this ratio of the semi-major axis cubed to the period squared. And we have the distances to the planet, so we know what A is, and we have the time it takes for the planets to go around the sun, so we have the period, so we can calculate the mass of the sun to high accuracy. So I talked about the difficulties of finding the light that is from the sun at the Earth. The atmosphere is not particularly transparent. It changes its transparency pretty rapidly. So we really had to wait till we could get above the Earth's atmosphere before we could get accurate measurements of the light flux from the sun, and that's when we discovered this very small change in the luminosity of the sun, depending upon the number of sunspots. But theoretically, particularly if the Earth's atmosphere were transparent, it wouldn't be any particular problem to measure the amount of energy that the sun is sending through a square meter. And it turns out, roughly speaking, it's about 1,500 watts per square meter for the energy we get from the sun. The luminosity is the total power output of the sun. Okay, so if it's putting 1,500 watts per square meter at the Earth, all we have to do is add up the number of square meters that it would take to surround the sun, and we get the total luminosity of the sun. So all we need to do to get the luminosity is the distance and the light intensity at the Earth. Surface temperature. So we've said lots of times that the general shape of incandescent objects, where the peak is located, can tell us the temperature of the object, right? So this is black body radiation. We have more blue light than red light as the temperature gets hotter and hotter and hotter, and we get more light at every wavelength. And that works pretty well for the sun, but maybe not ideally. Here's what the sun spectrum also actually looks like. So we've got lots of little absorption lines. Remember, the atmosphere of the sun contains basically every element in the periodic table. Every element in the periodic table has, you know, dozens of jumps, and each one of those jumps is going to produce an absorption line at a particular location. So there are literally hundreds of thousands of little absorption lines that affect the overall shape. But you know, in spite of that, you can still kind of pick out a maximum for where the peak wavelength would be if we didn't have all of these absorption lines between between us and the core of the sun. So right now I'm kind of describing the absorption lines as a problem that's obscuring the incandescent light that we're seeing from the sun. But in the future, we'll actually comment that the absorption lines are pretty helpful. So the surface temperature we can get from the peak wavelength and we've got this problem that, in fact, it's not a smooth curve. There are zillions of absorption lines. So it's kind of hard to pick out the actual shape of the blackbody curve. For the surface composition, we can use this problem, right? So if we know how absorptive the sodium is, we can measure that in our laboratory, and we see the depth of the absorption line, we can calculate the number of sodium atoms that are in the surface of the sun. And what we've said lots of times now is that, roughly speaking, 75% hydrogen, 25% helium, and 1% everything else that's in the periodic table. So vast majority of hydrogen and helium. So this process really isn't maybe quite as simple as I've described. So the fact that the sun is mostly hydrogen, people didn't know that 100 years ago. And kind of the reason they were fooled is if we look at the spectrum of the sun and we look up what all the prominent lines are in the sun, right? So this is sodium, for example. There are zillions of iron lines in the sun. So if you look at the prominent lines in the sun, it turns out that they are mostly ionized metals. And so, you know, quite naturally, circa 1900, people figured that's what the sun was mostly made out of. It was made out of hot iron, iron not being a particularly uncommon element. So why is it that hydrogen, and this is actually even more true of helium, why is it that hydrogen, even though it's most of the atmosphere of the sun, doesn't have prominent absorption lines in the sun? And the reason has to do with the particular jumps that hydrogen has. So So we've looked at the jumps that are the case of hydrogen. Right, so here are the various possibilities. These are being all shown as emission lines. Here are cases of absorption lines. And the lines that end in the ground state, or would start in the ground state, those all turn out to be ultraviolet absorption lines. And the ultraviolet light of the sun doesn't really penetrate to the surface of the Earth. So even though there should be a big absorption line at 13.6 electron volts, we couldn't see it, because the atmosphere is opaque to that sort of radiation. So the only jumps that are prominent in the visible light spectrum of the sun, well, there's a little bit of passion, but mostly it's these Balmer jumps, and in particular this jump that's between not the ground state, but the first excited state and the second excited state. So that turns out to produce a particular color of red that you saw when we looked at the absorptions line. So that's this particular, this is hydrogen, isn't it? Yeah, so it produces that particular color of red. The next jump up produces this particular color of blue-green, and so it goes. Those are all lines that are part of this Balmer series. The red is this one, the first blue one is that one, the next blue one is that one, and so it goes. So these are all jumps down, but of course what we're seeing in the sun spectra is absorption lines. So that requires the electron to be in this n equals 2 state in order to absorb light and go to this n equals 3 state. And that's pretty unlikely, right? We expect that the electron is going to be almost always in the ground state. So it's only a very small fraction, parts per billion, of the hydrogen that's in the sun's atmosphere that actually has the electron sitting at the level so that it can absorb a photon of light that occurs in the visible light spectrum. And that produces a not particularly prominent line here. Let's see if I can find it on this graph. Yeah. Is it capital C? Yeah, so it is actually that one. So it's not an unprominent line. It's just not the most prominent line in the picture of the sun. Okay, so the hydrogen line, the red H alpha line, requires the electron not in the ground state. So the electron had to be previously excited and then eat a photon in order to produce that red absorption line. Helium is even worse. So normal unionized helium turns out to have no absorption lines in the visible light spectra. So it's ionized helium that you would observe, but takes hot, really high temperatures to break apart the composite that is helium. So most of the absorption lines are actually caused by the miscellaneous elements in the periodic table that happen to have jumps that correspond to photons that are in the visible light spectrum. So people were confused for a long period of time, and it took some time to figure out that hydrogen was the main component. Helium is very hard to detect, so there have been a long period of time when people were uncertain about the amount of helium. And the other amounts are so small that it's not uncommon for people to make mistakes on figuring out their composition. So the exact chemical composition of the sun is kind of always up for grabs. You know, here's kind of one version of it. So this is based on number. So we have, if we had 1 million hydrogen atoms, then we're going to have basically 70,000 helium atoms, and so it goes. You might notice that, I mean, once you've seen that hydrogen is the most common and helium is the next most common, you might guess that the third most common thing would be the next thing that's on the periodic table, which is lithium and beryllium. But notice that that's not the case. So we kind of have an absence of these guys, and then we have carbon, oxygen, nitrogen as being relatively common things up until iron. So this is kind of a puzzle. Why is it that we have this sort of chemical composition? What caused it, the universe to be created with, roughly speaking, the same amounts of stuff? You might notice that this is called the cosmically abundant stuff. Turns out the sun is pretty usual, and the same composition of the sun applies to most stars, although not all stars. Okay, so surface composition we get from the absorption lines. And it's not an easy process. It's a process that you can be fooled about. It is something that we think we've gotten right now, but that's all always subject to a little bit of change. Literally the core conditions. So the bulk of the sun we can get from vibrations, but literally the temperature and density of stuff at the core, that really comes from these sorts of calculations. It just turns out that sound going right through the core is pretty unusual. And so the vibrations we see don't tell us a whole lot about the sun. Incidentally, the same thing is kind of true of the Earth. I mentioned before that the Earth has a solid inner core and then an outer liquid core. It turned out it took a fair amount of seismic activity before people could detect that there was a solid inner core right at the center of the Earth. Rotation, That's been known since Galileo's time. You just follow a sunspot and figure out how long it takes for that sunspot to be back at the same spot. And remember, we talked about differential rotation. It's not a term I'm super happy with. So that is representing the fact that if we just time how long it takes sunspots to go around the sun, it takes less time for them to go around the sun if they're near the equator than if they're near the pole. So the sun is not seeming to rotate as a solid object. The time it takes to orbit, as it were, to make one complete rotation is less at the poles than it is at other spots. And it's of course fine for a gaseous body not to be rotating as a solid object. One of the reasons I'm not fond of that name, differential rotation, is I think it kind of pushes you in the wrong direction. This is really more like weather. Remember that what we're calling the surface of the sun is not the surface of the sun. It's all atmosphere. And what this is saying, you know that the Earth has these things that are called jet streams, where we have high-speed air that's moving in particular from the west to east direction here at mid-latitudes. So what this is really saying is that there is a jet stream near the equator that is carrying the atmosphere around slightly faster than the bulk of the star. Questions? Okay, so we'd like to answer all of these same questions with stars. Right, the sun is a star. It's a particular star that's very, very, very close. How can we get the same data for other stars? And in particular, the nearest stars are like 4 light years away, so we can't use radar in order to calculate that distance. We have to find some other sort of approach in order to calculate that distance. And the approach that's used is kind of the same that is used for surveying, right? So if you want to figure out how far some mountaintop is away, all you need to do is to figure out these angles and this side, and you can use trigonometry to calculate the distance to those things. And we can actually do this. It's been since Tycho's time, people have done this to get the distance to the moon. You would have one measurement for where the moon seems to be on one side of the Earth, and one measurement for where the moon seems to be on the other side of the Earth, and you can calculate the distance to the moon. But the stars are way further away than the moon is, so just using a baseline that is the size of the planet isn't enough. These angles would all be undetectably the same if we were trying to measure the distances to stars. Incidentally, another way of saying the same thing is that this angle here, let me call it P for parallax, is very, very, very small for the stars. And you know those angles all have to add up to 180 degrees. So if that angle is very small, then both theta 1 and theta 2 are going to be pretty much 90 degrees, and we're not going to be able to tell that it's 90.000001, and the other one is 89.99999. So it's pretty hard to do. So what we need is a bigger baseline in order to use trigonometry to calculate the distances to the star. And the biggest available baseline, if you think about it, is the orbit of the Earth. Right? So if here is the sun, and here's the orbit of the Earth, and here's the star, we can be looking at this star in June, and we can be looking at this star in December, and by looking at the changing apparent location of that star, we have a huge baseline to AU, 300 million kilometers, and we have a shot at getting the distances to stars. And this is actually one of the things that Tycho tried to do, and it didn't work, right? The distances to the stars are so much larger than the size of the solar system that he basically got infinity for the distance to the stars. So this idea of parallax distance is important enough. Let's take a second and do one of these cheesy animations of it. So before we do this, let's take a few seconds out and take a look at these graphs of the inside of the sun. So this is a graph of the density inside of the sun, and this is mostly determinable by solar vibrations, by helioseismometry. And I guess what I want you to recognize is that, you know, the outer 5% of the sun is less dense than the air in this room. So the so-called surface of the sun is way less dense. We would call it pretty good vacuum. And it takes quite a ways before we get the gas compressed to these extremely high densities. As I say, 10 times the density of lead there at the core of the sun. Kind of the same thing is true of temperature. So we've got these way hot temperatures, 15 million degrees of the core, but most of the change in temperature happens in the outer layers of the sun, in the convective zone. So I was talking about the differential rotation inside the sun. So here are different rotation speeds, and you can see as a function of distance inside of the sun, you can see that the outer parts of the sun are rotating fast, the parts that are closer to the pole are rotating slower, but if we go deep enough into the sun, basically below the convective layer, that's where we start to see the sun rotating as a solid body. So this different rotation layer is just an atmospheric effect. It doesn't go all the way through the sun. Mostly what's going on here is that we have a high-speed jet that is rotating in the same direction that the sun is rotating in, and that's causing that. Okay, so here's one of these kind of cheesy pictures. Here we have a nearby star against distant stars, and we can look at what happens to the apparent location of that star as the sun goes around in its orbit. And you can see that sometimes it seems to be near this yellow star, sometimes it seems to be over there. Its apparent change in location gives us the angle that it is to that star. And the further away that star is, the smaller that angle is. So there's an inverse relationship between that parallax phenomena. So here's a relatively close by star, and we can see that at different times of the year it moves by a relatively large distance. As they go to more and more distant stars, its apparent change in location gets less and less and less. And eventually it becomes basically impossible to measure. It doesn't seem to be changing at all. Okay. Parallax. Probably the single most important measurement that we make about the stars. So kind of third time's the charm. You can do parallax yourself because you have two different points of view. And if you put your thumb in front of your eyes, you can see that the apparent location of your sun, of your thumb, changes according to which eye you're looking through. If you move your thumb further and further away, then the apparent change in the location of the sun, of the thumb, is less and less and less. Okay, so parallax, that's the apparent change in location of a star. due to the change in location of the Earth as it runs through a baseline, and that allows us to get the distance. And it's an inverse relationship. The greater the distance, the smaller the parallax. So it goes 1 over that angle. So I think way back in the first class, I mentioned this kind of funny unit that the astronomers have invented, parsec. It's about 3 1/3 light years. A parsec is a parallax. If a star has a distance of 1 parsec, then it has a parallax of 1 arc second. And if you remember your angular measurements, in 1 degree, there are 60 minutes. And in 1 minute, there are 60 arc seconds. So if the change in angle is 1/3600th of a degree, then the star has a distance of 1 parsec. If it has a parallax change in position of 1/10th of an arc second, then it's 10 parsecs away. And so it goes. Now, the one helpful thing about parsec to remember has to do with atmospheric seeing. So remember that automatically when we look at stars from the ground, they're blurred out, and kind of under the best possible conditions, the amount of the blurring is about 1 arc second. So this change in position for the nearest stars is nothing like these diagrams. So this is a matter of the star moving from one spot to its diameter. So it moves from here to there to the most nearby stars. So it's pretty hard, it's extremely hard to measure. We had to wait till Bessel in 1838 in order to measure this very small angular change in the position of the nearest stars. And you can guess that, you know, it's pretty hard to measure changes in angle that are 1/100th the size of the thing that you're trying to measure. So it's very difficult to measure distances to stars that are more than 100 parsecs. I don't know, 100 parsecs may sound like a big distance, but it's basically nothing astronomically. So, I don't know, roughly speaking, the galaxy is on the order of 10,000 parsecs in size. And of course, our galaxy is one of billions of galaxies. So parallax is only going to work for maybe 1,000 or so nearby stars. It's not going to get us to a long list of stars. So we're going to need more distance measurements, more ways to measure distance in the future. And it's going to turn out that measuring distance in astronomy is always a tough thing to do. Parallax is the gold standard. We can use it for the most nearby stars, and since it's just based on geometry, it's a surefire method. I hope it's obvious that the best way to measure parallax is to get above the atmosphere. And the Europeans launched a satellite, I don't know, 10 years ago, which was solely dedicated to that purpose, to measuring the parallax above the Earth's atmosphere. So they radically expanded the catalog of stars whose distances we actually knew. Depending upon how accurately you think their satellite was, maybe there are 100,000 stars whose distances we know. Unfortunately, there's something wrong with that data, and we know that for sure. Not hugely wrong, but slightly wrong. So people are in the business of sending up another satellite to kind of redo those measurements. Okay, so a good collection, 1,000 stars, 100,000 stars, are close enough that we can get their distance by this surveying method that is known as parallax. A very small fraction of the total, but nevertheless a good number. angular size. So I've just been talking about atmospheric seeing, and I commented that if you look with a telescope, kind of under the best possible circumstances, the star's image is going to be blurred by about an arc second. And that has nothing to do with the actual diameter of the star. Typical actual diameters of stars would be a thousandth of that. So we can't actually measure the diameter of the star, the actual diameter of stars using ground-based telescopes. And actually, even things like the Hubble Space Telescope have only measured the diameters of the biggest nearest by stars. So for typical stars, there's just no way we can measure the very small angle that would be the angular size of that star. So the kind of the most commonly used approach to get the angular size of stars is by lunar occultation. So eclipse is usually the word we used for the moon-sun situation. Occultation is the more general case where we have something that is moving in front of something else. So the plan is to take a star which is right on the path of the moon and time how long it takes for the star to be dimmed because the edge of the moon has covered it up. And that's a great measure way to measure the apparent diameter of stars. It has the disadvantage that the moon has to go by the star, and of course the moon only goes by a very small fraction of the celestial sphere, right? The ecliptic, well, it's only half a degree wide, and relatively small stars work. It also has to be a pretty bright star. So we need a bright star on the ecliptic in order to get to use this measurement to get the angular size of stars. And as I say, for nearby stars, the rough size of this would be thousandths milliarc seconds. So if we've got the distance and the angular size, then we can get a measurement of the radius of those stars. But this is going to be a very small fraction of all stars, right? So in order to get the distance, it has to be one of these stars that we can get the parallax to, 1,000, 100,000 stars. It also has to then be on the ecliptic, which is a very small fraction of that. So we're talking about, I don't know, maybe hundreds of stars whose radius we can get by this sort of approach. So to get the mass, all we need to do is to have something that's orbiting that star. And it turns out the majority of stars are binary stars. They're not like our sun that just has planets going around it. They have stars going around stars. And stars are bright, so we can see them at a distance. So we can see two dots, and we can see how those two dots move around each other. And so these are called binary stars. So the problem here is that in order to apply Kepler's third law, which I guess I managed to erase, we need to get the period and the distance that the stars are apart. Now the period's no problem, right? We just wait long enough for them to go around each other. The semi-major axis is a little bit of a problem, because we can see what angle they are apart, but in order to convert that angle to a distance, we have to be using the usual trigonometry. Right? So we can see that, you know, now that star is half a degree to the left of that star, now it's half a degree to the right of that star, But what that half a degree is in terms of kilometers, we need to know the actual distance. So the set of stars that we can actually get the mass of is somewhat limited, again, to on the order of 1,000 stars. And so what I've been describing is where we see the stars as two dots. We then monitor those two dots and see how long they take to go around. And using the distance, we can convert the angle to actual kilometers to plug into this formula to get the actual mass of it. So binary stars like this are called visible binary stars. And the fact that there's an adjective there tells you that there are going to be lots of different types of binary stars. And we'll talk about those probably tomorrow. Okay, so out of literally billions of stars, there are on the order of thousands of stars that we can get the, well, maybe 1,000 stars, that we can get the mass and the radius and the distance to. Getting the light flux of one of those stars on Earth isn't too much of a problem. Again, if we're out, like at our observatory, we're under the ocean of air, we have to make corrections for the changing transparency of the Earth's atmosphere, and that requires a certain amount of calibration. But a priori, getting the brightness of that star, the magnitude, is a relatively straightforward process. So you remember the magnitude of stars is this backwards way of measuring the brightness of stars, so that magnitude 6 stars are ones that you probably can just barely see with your eye under the best possible circumstances, and the brightest stars are magnitude 0, magnitude minus 1, again not counting the sun, which has a magnitude of something like minus 26. And maybe this is as good a time as any to talk a little bit about magnitude. So we owe this mistake to Hipparchus. He was the guy who, without any measuring instruments other than his eye, kind of described magnitude 1, 2, and 3 classes of stars. And then as people tried to put actual numbers on the light flux, they tried to figure out what was behind what Hipparchus actually saw. And the answer probably seems funny, but there's a rule of psychology that says that typically most detectors for living creatures are based on logarithms. So what's a logarithm? Think back to high school. Yeah, so instead of writing 55 as some number, we're going to write it as 10 to some power. And it's going to be some fractional power, and that power is the logarithm. So the upshot is that logs have to do with powers, and hence ratios. So before we talk about light, let's talk about other, you know, common human experiences. I've said that sound is probably the one that we have the best detectors on. So how do we measure sound intensity? In decibels. And there's a huge range of sounds that you can hear, from the pin drop to rock bands to airplanes. So there's a huge range that we want to cover. And of course, by dealing with exponents, we have the ability to have relatively small numbers cover a huge range of possibilities. And so in fact, decibels are based on a logarithmic measurement of the sound intensity. So in terms of physical units, if we were talking about the intensity of sound, we would be talking about, just as we were talking about for sunlight, we'd be talking about energy per area. And sound again, equations aren't a big deal in this class, so you're never going to use that equation. My only point here is that when we measure sound, we're actually basing it on a logarithmic scale. And the same thing is true of magnitudes. They're based on a kind of funny logarithmic measurement with, of course, a minus sign, because things are going to go backwards. Of the intensity of the light divided by some standard intensity. And what's used for this standardizing intensity is the star Vega. So basically what we're doing when we're finding the magnitude of a star is we're comparing it to how bright Vega is. What fraction is it of Vega? And that's a good way to do it, because it means that we kind of automatically take into account the transparency of the Earth's atmosphere, right? If we measure Vega and we measure that star, we're looking through the same atmosphere. All we have to do then is calculate that ratio, and we can get the magnitude of that star. Okay, so magnitude system works backwards so that dimmer stars are brighter. It's based on the exponent, which is to say ratios comparing the star to traditionally to Vega. And it's not a particularly difficult measurement to make. Do it all the time at the observatory. So something can seem dim because it's actually dim, right? It couldn't be a 5-watt bulb, or it could be a 100-watt bulb that's, you know, a mile away. Still would look awfully dim. So just because we know that a star has a dim magnitude, which is to say a big magnitude, we don't necessarily know how bright the star actually is, what its luminosity is. So we can use the same approach for stars as we do for the sun. If we know the light flux at Earth and we know the distance to the star, so if we know how many watts per square meter it is at Earth, all we need to do is to calculate the number of square meters it would take to fully surround that star, so we get all of the light, and we can get the corresponding luminosity. And the thing I want to stress in this, and actually for lots of these things we've been talking about, is we need distance. So I can't tell you whether Betelgeuse is intrinsically brighter or dimmer than Vega unless I know the distances to those stars. And it turns out, in the case of Betelgeuse, it's way beyond what you can measure with parallax. So the distance to Betelgeuse turns out to be something that you can argue about, because we don't have a surefire way of getting that distance. So surface temperature. So magnitude is something that depends on distance, but temperature is temperature, right? The difference kind of between an intensive quantity and an extensive quantity. So roughly speaking, we should be able to get the surface temperature by the peak wavelength. We have a problem of all of these absorption lines. And if we actually look at the spectra of a wide range of stars, it turns out that the sun is kind of the best case for being able to pick out a peak wavelength. For most stars, the light is, you know, kind of much less definitely oriented in terms of peak. So for these stars here, the peak is certainly outside the range of visible wavelength, so we can't even measure it. Here we have something like a peak, but actually it's you're being fooled by a big absorption line that's right there. And these are other stars where it becomes, I don't know, you can see it's increasingly problematic to figure out where the peak is. So while theoretically peak wavelength is a good approach, and it works pretty well for the sun, for most stars, it just doesn't work. It's too hard to figure out where the peak is. So what's going to be the solution? Well, the solution is going to be those absorption lines and the mantra that high temperatures break apart composites. So you know that here on the Earth, the atmosphere of this planet is all made of molecules where we have atoms bound together, right? And if we increase the temperature, those atoms will break apart. And if we increase the temperature still more, those atoms will ionize, will break the electron free from the atom. And if we heat it up to extremely high temperatures, we can even break apart the nuclei, because high temperatures do work against composites. And if we think about that in the context of these absorption lines, okay, so I guess I have to, before I maybe bring this up, I have to introduce some kind of funny notation. So my guess is that when you took chemistry, you learned about things like calcium double plus. No. You didn't take chemistry?
I only took high school level first chemistry.
That's all I took. So you didn't learn things like sodium chloride is a combination of positively charged...
We wrote it differently. We didn't call it double plus. We
wrote it differently. Oh, I see. People, your profs were more careful than me, huh? Like that. Yeah. I'm just lazy. And of course, if we have bigger numbers, then we can actually put numerals here, right? Plus three. Okay. Well, I'm not sure exactly why the spectroscopists and the chemists got on different wavelengths, but they have totally different notations. And this is spectroscopy, so here we have spectroscopy notation. So you might see Fe Roman numeral 1 there. Fe stands for iron, and the 1 means the unionized version. And if you look at Fe2, a chemist would call that Fe plus. And so it goes, Fe3 would be Fe plus 2. And so it's just one off between the two groups. I guess I know some of that history, but it's maybe not all that exciting. So let's take a look at these series of graphs here. So these are dealing with how strong the absorption line is from silicon. But this isn't normal garden variety silicon. This is ionized silicon. And this is doubly ionized silicon. And this is triply ionized silicon. And kind of no surprise, as we increase the temperature, what was singly ionized sodium silicon becomes doubly ionized silicon, becomes triply ionized sodium, because the ever higher temperatures are breaking apart that composite more and more and more. So if we look at a star and we see singly ionized silicon, we know what the temperature has to be, roughly. And since we have literally hundreds of thousands of lines to look at, we can have really pretty accurate measurements of the temperature.
Mm-hmm. When you're reading a chart like this, where the scale is actually changing,
Yeah, this is a very confusing chart. So let me do some examples. So the usual chart that we've been dealing with, a spectra, is a chart of wavelength versus the amount of light. And let's say that silicon plus one has an absorption line at this location, and silicon plus two has an absorption line at that location. So what this chart is saying is if the temperature of the star is someplace like there, we're not going to have absorption from this and we're not going to have absorption from that. So maybe the spectra looks kind of like that. As we increase the temperature a little bit, we start to see a increased depth of the absorption line for silicon 2. So now we still don't see anything from doubly ionized silicon, but maybe we see a little glitch. As we increase the temperature some more, that line becomes more prominent, which is to say deeper. As we increase the temperature some more, that line becomes less prominent. And at the same time, we start to see a little bit of a glitch from silicon 3.
Well, the question I was going to ask is when you're reading that, if you were to try to find a point in between, would it be like between 5,900 and 7,000? Would the exact midpoint be like...
Okay. So I didn't answer your question at all, is the short, long and the short of it, right? So what he's pointing out is this is a crazy scale, right? So this isn't any sort of uniform increments, right? So the distance between these two guys is, 1,300 degrees. Difference between these guys is 700 degrees. And now that same distance is now 2,000. Well, I guess it's 1,100 degrees. But it's not at all consistent. And I have no idea what this scale is. My guess is that this scale is based on roughly the inverse of the temperature. So with the funny graphs that we did with the solar system plots, where we had the same sort of 1, 10, 100 scales, those were logarithmic scales. You can also make scales that plot things like the inverse of a number. Yeah, so I have no idea why they made the scale this way. It's not particularly helpful for reading out. So if I found that it was here, I have no good way to figure out what the temperature is. But believe me, they have things with more normal scales on them. More questions? So the only thing I could say is roughly what you said. This, if the point is here, it has to be someplace between 10,000 and 30,000. And whether that's 20,000 or 15,000 or 25,000, I could not tell you right now. More questions? Okay, so the plan is to look at a spectra of a star which has zillions of absorption lines in it, and then look at the ratios of the strength of, say, unionized iron and ionized iron. If we have more and more ionized stuff, it must mean that we have more higher and higher temperatures. But do notice the way this works, right? So we start with, say, singly ionized silicon. If the temperature is low enough, it's all unionized silicon. If the temperatures are hot enough, it's all more than singly ionized silicon. So the strength of this line gets big for a while and then goes down. And that can be confusing because if with just one of these elements, if you measure the strength of the line, the temperature might be that or it might be that. So the only way we can really do this is if we have lots of lines to deal with, and we do. Right, so here's the absorption line for H1, and remember this is really the line that we were talking about, the Balmer line, the line that is the electron in the first excited state. So at low temperatures, the hydrogen is mostly in the ground state, and so it's not absorbing. At higher temperatures, the hydrogen is mostly ionized, so there's no electron to be doing the jumps period. It's only kind of in this in-between period where we have a lot of hydrogen that is in the first excited state, and so can it can absorb that particular color of red light that knocks the electron from n equals 2 to n equals 3. Incidentally, stars that have this sort of very strong hydrogen absorption lines are stars like Vega, which was the standard for the magnitude system. Okay, so the best way to get surface temperature is with the line ratios. And recognizing this mantra that high temperatures break apart composites. So as we go to more and more ionized material, we're talking about higher and higher temperature stars. So the coolest stars have molecules in their atmosphere. And in the hottest stars, the helium, which is very difficult to ionize, being an inert gas, you can see we start to get ionized helium only at the very strongest sorts of temperatures. Okay, so surface composition, we're also going to get that from the line strengths. We can add up all of the silicon that's in all of those ionized states and get the total amount of silicon. Add up all of the ionized states of iron and get the total amount of iron and figure out what fraction of it is in those various compositions. As I say, the upshot is that most stars have pretty much the same composition as the sun. 75% hydrogen, 25% helium, and some else. Incidentally, the major deviations of stars is in the exact amount of else. So some stars might have 2% else, some stars might have a tenth of a percent else. It's the else that seems to vary the most in terms of composition of stars. So before we had to get core conditions by calculation, and that's no different here. If we can't see inside the sun, we're not going to be able to see inside these other stars. Incidentally, people are just starting to be able to do this sort of seismometry with other stars. The sun is hugely bright, so of course it's a lot easier to look in detail at its spectra to look for these very small Doppler shifts. And people are just starting to be able to do that with distant stars. So for most stars, we don't have really great data aside from calculations, what the insides are like. Rotation. Well, it turns out that we have exactly the same way of doing rotation that we have for the sun. That is to say, we have the fact that there are spots on the surfaces of stars, and as they rotate, we can see the star slightly dim and slightly brighten, and we can time how long it takes for those stars, so those spots, to get back to the same situation. But there's another way that works to find the diameters of stars, or excuse me, the rotation rate of stars. It is a little bit subtle. And that has to do with the Doppler effect. So if we have a rotating star, part of the star is always moving towards us and part of the star is always moving away from us. And that's going to shift these absorption lines slightly to the left and the right. So here we have a fast rotating star and here we have a slow rotating star. And if you look, you can see that what's happening is that these lines have all been broadened by having part of it being blue shifted and part of it being red shifted by the rotation of the star. And I want to stress that the precise nature of the Doppler effect for a rotating star is the following, that it turns a line that looks like that into a line that looks like that. So that it has basically the same area, so this is an absorption line, it has basically the same amount of missing light, but now it's spread out over a larger distance, and instead of being pointy, it's rounded. Okay, so we'll talk more about how to find the properties of stars next time.